Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Not Another Mummy Podcast with me, Alison Perry. My guest today is Kathy Ray, a single mum of two girls, an editor and freelance journalist for publications like Glamour and The Guardian, and disability consultant. Kathy was born with achondroplasia, and her daughters were too. She recently contributed to We've Got This, a book of essays and reflections on disabled parenting, and she joins me today to share her experiences. Welcome, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks.
You said that you weren't quite awake. Is that the clocks have changed just in the week that we're recording this? Has that affected you?
I don't know why, but like it's only an hour. It doesn't really affect me much, but it affects the kids, and then that affects me, right?
Yeah.
And they've just been really tired the last 2 days. It's been a struggle.
It's hard, isn't it? Because your kids, are they 4 and 8?
They're 5 and 8.
5 and 8. And even that, you think once they're out of the baby and toddler phase, something like the clock change, it's all good, it's fine. But it does still affect them, doesn't it?
Yeah. And in my kids' cases, they get really tired. And I think that might be partly a disability thing as well, because life is just more exhausting for us.
Yeah.
But I don't really remember being, I remember being a tired kid. But I don't remember how tired I was or what my boundaries were around that. So I'm kind of learning this with my kids, because obviously mine are different now. I'm an adult, right? And it's interesting. It's interesting.
Well, also, I guess I'm guessing as well that when you're a kid with a disability, you have nothing to compare it to. All you've got is your experience. So how do you know whether you're more tired or less tired than your friends?
Right, exactly. And then, but then what's interesting is that, like, even as a kid growing up with achondroplasia, with no history of it in my family, we were a big, my parents made a big effort for us to be very involved in dwarfism communities. And so I actually knew a lot of people growing up with dwarfism, and my parents got a lot of advice and learned a lot from other people. But even when you meet those people and you get to learn things that are like symptomatic of your disability that nobody actually really talks about if they don't have dwarfism, it obviously, just like with non-disabled people, there's a spectrum of everything, right? And so I used to think, well, I'm more tired than like one of my friends who's still my friend now, and it's just because she's a particularly active person even though she has dwarfism, right? And so it's funny, because you can get in that kind of mindset of like, oh well, that's because I have dwarfism, but it's dwarfism, but also it's just my body and my level of fitness and my lifestyle and everything else.
I mean, it sounds like from the way you describe your parents, it sounds like they were and are amazing, and you know, really did everything they could, as much as they could, to help you. What was your childhood like? Like, and what kind of conversations have you had with your parents now that you're a parent yourself? Have you kind of chatted to them about what it was like for them to give birth to a baby that had dwarfism and everything else that came with it for them as parents?
Yeah, we've talked about it quite a lot. My mum always used to talk about it when I was growing up as well, like in the sense of, you know, she used to tell me, well, doctors used to say, because they didn't know that I had dwarfism until I was born, there were less scans back then, I guess, and also they weren't looking for it and stuff like that. And so I was born, and then the doctors were like, oh no, there's a problem. And but my parents just like weren't, I don't know, they describe it as they weren't at all fazed by it and they were totally cool with it. I don't know what it was like in reality. I'm sure they had a moment of shock, because why wouldn't they? I would have a moment of shock if I gave birth to a child that had a different disability. Like, it's natural. It's normal to feel that. It doesn't make you a bad parent. But they were very, like, you know, they loved me from the beginning and they were accepting from the beginning, and they just, I don't know, they just kind of knew that they had a bit of extra work to do, and they were like, they rolled up their sleeves and they started doing it, especially my mum. And just not because my dad was any more less active, but just, you know, the way parent roles are, I guess. I do say I was lucky. I don't like using that phrase because I think it's deserved of all people as a bare minimum of how your parents should be. But I do recognise that lots of parents aren't like that.
And it was the late 80s you were born, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So attitudes to things like dwarfism, I mean, we're not even where we should be now today in 2023. There's still a lot of ableism.
Right.
Back then, like, it must have been on a different scale.
Yeah. No, there was loads, definitely. The funny thing about dwarfism is, even back then, when you're a baby who has dwarfism, I mean, obviously I didn't register any ableism, but everyone just thinks you're really cute because you're like a mini baby, and you look so super squishy. You've got like all these bunched up arms and bunched up legs, and everyone's just like, oh, so adorable. But it's then as you grow older and the differences become more pronounced and the height difference becomes more pronounced, that's when you suddenly become a victim of bullying and ableism, and, you know, you realize inaccessibility and stuff like that. But actually, as a baby and stuff, it's very kind of, yeah, there just isn't. And I've seen that through having my own children, you know, and how they were treated as babies and how they're treated by society now is very, very different.
What kind of age were you when you realized yourself that you wanted to have your own children?
Really young. I really wanted my parents to have more kids after me. My dad has two kids, but from a previous marriage. So my siblings lived together with their mum. And I saw them regularly, but not that regularly, because we moved quite far away from them. And I always just felt jealous that they had each other and I didn't have anybody in the house. So I begged my parents for another kid and stuff. And through circumstances that were no fault of their own, they were unable to have any more. And then so kind of once that was put to bed, I was like, well, if I'm going to have kids, I want to make sure I have more than one. And I just had it really set in my mind. I always wanted a busy house. I grew up in really in a really poor area of the country, very rural North Norfolk. And a lot of the families I grew up around, I lived on council estates, were very big. And I wanted that. I wanted this huge family, chaotic, messy lifestyle. Even where the mum was like shouting at the kids and stuff, I was like, this is great. I love this. That's not to say that that only happens in working class families. I know it doesn't, but that was just my experience growing up on the council estate. And so, yeah, I had it fixed very early on. And as I said, like, once I realised my parents couldn't have any more kids, that was just became my kind of mission to have my own.
And you've said that for a long time you felt like it would never happen for you. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, I felt like I don't know if I felt like it would never happen. I felt like there would be barriers. I just felt like it would be hard. Like, maybe I think I'd at the time that I was feeling that, which was like in my late 20s more, I knew a lot of people who experienced infertility and who had, you know, chronic illnesses that meant that pregnancy was a risk and things like that. I got scared and I just thought, oh, maybe this is going to be too difficult for me to do. Maybe my body won't be able to handle it. I'm not as fit as my other fit friend who has dwarfism. And, you know, maybe I just yeah, it will just be too difficult and I won't be able to have kids.
What are the limitations? If you have dwarfism, are there any more risks to pregnancy? Or you've talked about how when you had your kids, lifting them could be quite tricky for you. Sure. Did you find the same when you were, when you had a bump and you were carrying that extra weight?
Yeah, what was really weird for me, well, one slight advantage to that in terms of our bodies as parents is that so we have to have C-sections, and it is a huge medical risk if we suddenly go into labor. So we have to have a C-section in advance, well in advance, so that there's like literally 0.01% of going to into labor risk. So I'm with my first daughter, she was premature anyway. So she was born at 7 months and my bump was tiny. I just didn't really grow. My belly just hardened. And that was just my genetic makeup that did that. And that's not a thing like within dwarfism. Some bellies can be huge, some aren't, but like mine just didn't really grow. And so it wasn't until that last couple of weeks that I really felt a massive difference. And I was just, you know, when I, because I had no kids at home, I was able to relax a lot more and take it easy. And I lived not far from where I worked at the time. And then with my second daughter, that was definitely a bit harder because I already had another kid at home. I was physically exerting myself always with her, especially because dwarfism means that she's physically delayed. So although she was 3.5, she required me to do a lot for her still. And I carried my second to 8 months. And so that last month and a bit was hard. But I don't know that it's that much harder than it is for an average height parent. But I've got no idea because obviously I don't have an average height body. But from what I hear and from what I particularly experienced, it definitely wasn't. But I was also really lucky because I didn't have any issues like, I don't know, preeclampsia or diabetes or things that can come on in pregnancy. I didn't have any of that stuff. I think I just had a relatively smooth, other than the premature birth, a relatively smooth experience.
You said that you had a pretty traumatic conversation with a sonographer, was it, when they basically spoke to you as if your baby having dwarfism meant that it had something wrong with it. Did you experience much of that kind of those sort of conversations with health workers? Or
no, not that was a one-off. I mean, it was a horrible thing for them to a horrible way for them to approach the conversation. But as per my personality, I scolded them and told them why that wasn't okay, and they were mortified, and then that was it. I think that me having the same disability meant that a lot of people were afraid to show ableism, in fact. And there was a lot of kind of eggshells being walked on by medical professionals around my pregnancies that I just don't think would be afforded to average height adults having kids with dwarfism. I don't think it would be the same. And that's really sad because they're the ones that actually need the reassurance and the acceptance, because they're the ones who'll be like freaking out that that their baby's going to be different to how they imagined, right? And and they're the ones that need people who are going to tell them, oh no, it's going to be okay, and you know, you're going to have to do this differently, but your baby's going to be loved, and you know, all of these things.
That's so good that you were able to challenge that person. I think so many of us, especially in, you know, a hospital environment where these people are experts, it can feel really hard to actually say, actually, what you've just said isn't okay, or, you know, so that's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, in that particular situation, I felt quite empowered. I had my husband next to me. We were both like, what are you doing? And we just challenged it. I don't challenge it every time because it's exhausting if you challenge every single bit of ableism that you come across. But that just really, like, in the moment stuck out to me as like a massive error on their part that I just really didn't want them to impart in the future. And obviously I'm not naive to say that they wouldn't necessarily exhibit ableism in the future, but hopefully by me calling it out what it was, that might have helped them to reflect a little bit.
Yeah. Now, with your first daughter being premature, you said that in the first few months of her life, you suffered from postnatal depression. Do you think that that was a direct response to having an emergency C-section at 7 months and being thrust into motherhood almost a lot, you know, a lot earlier than you were imagining?
Yeah, I mean, we weren't ready at all. I'm not like the greatest at preparing for things anyway. I mean, I wasn't even prepared for this Zoom call today because my headphones don't work. But but we really weren't ready. I bought a Moses basket, but nothing else. And, you know, I had a few bits of clothing that were like given to us, but because she was so tiny, A, because she had dwarfism, and B, because she was premature, she didn't fit into, like, everything drowned her. And I think I had this, I don't know, I just had this fairy tale of how that was all going to go. And it didn't involve her staying in hospital for 7.5 weeks. It was an hour away from our house that we couldn't get to because we didn't have a car. And all of that, you know, and there was just a lot of grief I had to move through in the first kind of 6 months of her life, really, because everything was so much harder than I had anticipated. And part of that was naivety and not being prepared and not reading up on things either. You know, I didn't know anything about premature babies. I knew they existed, but I didn't know how that worked and what that meant for parents and things like that. And I wish I had known some people to tell me stuff like that, just so, because I just felt like very alone in that experience, and everybody else I knew that either had children or were having children didn't have that experience. And so I was just like, well, who do I talk to about this? And it's like, nobody. You know, there are obviously charities, and I didn't want to talk to a stranger. I wanted to talk to someone that understood me. It was difficult. And then when she came home, she was, because she was so early, she had really bad digestive issues, really severe, digestive issues, and also respiratory issues. So we were constantly on watch with her, and it just felt like more than the average baby. Like, we just couldn't leave her alone. When we were feeding her, we were also terrified because she would choke a lot, or she would not choke, but she would cough a lot and splutter and be sick, and she got like writhing tummy pains and colic and really bad wind, because her body just wasn't ready for what was happening. Just all of that just meant that, like, yeah, that first 6 months was hard.
So it strikes me then that, you know, a few years later, when you went on to have your second daughter, that feeling that you described earlier of really wanting more than one child to create that noisy, messy atmosphere must have been such a strong feeling to, I guess.
Yeah, that was unwavering, because I knew we were going to get through what we got through with my first. You know, it was awful. But it was a short, like, I mean, and also it was amazing. Don't get me wrong, like, having a baby is amazing. But that the first 6 months was hard. But yeah, I don't know. It was unwavering. I was just like, no, I'm definitely going to have another one. And I was second time around, you know, managed to have her at 8 months. And I think, you know, her system was a lot more mature than my first. And so we didn't have any issues. She was an incredible sleeper from the beginning. It was just very, very easy. My personal life was a dumpster fire, but my life with my babies was great. It's luck of the draw as to whether, you know, kids can be different, and you can have the same parents and treat them in the same way, but they're still going to be different.
So true, so true.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So how do you think that your experiences of parenting has been different then because of your disability?
God, so many ways. With my first, I went to some mother and baby groups at the beginning, especially because we lived somewhere. We had just moved to the county of Hampshire. We don't live there anymore, but we had just moved there. And I didn't know anyone. So we moved there when I was 5 months, and then I had her at 7 months. And I literally knew nobody apart from my office mates, who I didn't really know well. And I joined a few mother and baby groups. I found those really hard because I found myself comparing myself and my situation to theirs a lot, to other parents in the group, and which obviously on the surface look a lot easier than they probably are in real life, right? And a lot more put together than they probably are in real life. But when you're sleep deprived and you're emotional, and you know your baby cries a lot and stuff, and your back hurts, it's hard, it's tough. And I remember I used to go to a group that was just opposite where I live, 2 minute walk with my first kid. And then when we got home, I would just sit on the sofa with her for 5 hours because I was wiped out. And obviously that's not like the average experience of a parent. Yeah. But everything was just so much more tiring. And part of that was because she cried a lot. But part of it was obviously because we were both disabled. And I was the primary caregiver. It's definitely like, the way that you have to manage your energy is so, so precious. Like, you have to really think it out. And I've got to balance that also with the mental health issue of, like, if I stay indoors all day, every day, obviously I'm going to feel really depressed. So I need to go out. But I have to figure out what are the safest environments for me to go out where I don't end up feeling worse. But I can have some kind of interactions. And unfortunately, with my first kid, I never figured that out. And with my second, I didn't go to any mother and child groups, or mother and baby groups, toddler groups, whatever. But by that point, we had moved to where we live now. And I had lots of friends. And so loads of people came to visit me. I went to other people. And so my maternity, I started volunteering at a local mother and baby, play space, where I didn't have to get involved in any of the politics if I didn't want to. I could just like be around other people with my baby and stuff. And the experience was just a lot better for me. But I guess, the first time around, firstly, I didn't have any friends and stuff anyway, but also I didn't anticipate how different the experience would be and how isolated it would then make me feel to be in a room full of people who all had a baby but were experiencing a trajectory of motherhood that was so different to mine.
Yeah. I guess that's what's so valuable about things like the book, We've Got This, in that you have this collection of parents sharing their experiences, and that is such an amazing tool for prospective disabled parents to read.
Yeah.
And soak in all of those, you know, those experiences.
Definitely. I mean, nothing can prepare you for being a parent, but yeah, that kind of thing just hasn't existed before. And I think it's really powerful. And reading the book myself, like, because I hadn't read any of the other contributions before it was published. And, you know, reading all the different experiences that are in it, it's so rich with different experiences. And it's so valuable, because it's like, you know, you've got disabled parents who have children through IVF or who adopt, which, and obviously that's going to be a really different situation to mine. You've got disabled parents who are single, you've got disabled parents who are in a couple, you've got a disabled parent who is in a couple with another disabled person, or not with a disabled person, you know, and it's all really different. And whilst the experiences of me, a single mom who has dwarfism with two kids who have dwarfism, is not going to be exactly the same as another single mom who has dwarfism with two kids who have dwarfism, even if you go through all the identity factors, it's never going to be the same. There are going to be so many like strands where you can relate and feel seen in a way that you can't by traditional motherhood.
And what kind of part do you feel social media has played in helping disabled parents? I mean, I'm guessing that it's a double-edged sword, just like social media is across the board, in terms of, you know, it gives people platforms and it connects people and to share their experiences, but then it also creates a space for trolls to come in and people to, I guess, be ignorant and share their ignorant views with you. How have you kind of found that over the years?
I recently made the decision not to share my children anymore or their personalities on social media. So I might share things that we've been doing, but I don't want to share them. And the reason I made that decision is a few reasons, but up until that point, I had shared them. I'd shared like things that things about them, and people had a flavor of who they were. Obviously only a flavor, because I would only share a bit, but you know how we like to generalize, like if someone's bossy one day, if it's my kid or someone else, you know, we think, oh, that's a bossy person. And so what I hadn't anticipated was that the flattening of their identities or my identity that would occur through sharing on social media. And I began to feel increasingly uncomfortable with the messages I would get, like, oh, I'm sure Mariana, your oldest kid, would love this, or I'm sure she would react like this to this. Mm-hmm, and yeah. I'm like, oh, you don't know her, actually. You only know what I share, and that is a very small part. And obviously what I share is going to be through my own glasses, through my own perspective, and my own trauma and my own baggage. And so it's not fact either, you know? Yeah. And so I didn't like that. And the reason I shared for so long anyway was because I felt like there are so few disabled parents in the public eye who have disabled children. In the UK, there's me and Nina Tame, you know, and like we're both white middle class people. But that's it, you know. And I mean, forgive me if there are other people, but there aren't other people that I know of. And so I felt like it was really valuable to share. And I had a couple of friends in other countries who have dwarfism and have kids who have dwarfism who share on social media. And I thought, nah, this is great. Over the years, I kind of thought, actually, this isn't my decision to make. This is my kid's decision to make. And whilst I can kind of dress it up as I'm doing it for representation, what's it really, what is it actually changing and achieving?
And also, how will they feel about it when, you know, when they're a bit older? You know, you've got no guarantee that they're going to be like, yes, mum, thanks so much for sharing my life on the internet for the greater good. Right. They might be like, you know, F you.
Yeah.
Can't believe you did that, you know.
Right, exactly. And that was a recent decision I made. But I know it's a contentious issue, and I know a lot of parents, like not just disabled parents, any parent that is, any mother particularly that is on social media has very different views on this. And I, you know, I respect other people's views, and I see both sides.
Just like with all aspects of parenting, we all do it differently. We always make decisions that feel right for us at the time for our kids.
Exactly. And, you know, I think, yeah, yeah, So that's where I've kind of landed on it. But it's taken me a long time to get there.
Yeah, but it's a tricky one to work through, I think.
Definitely. And I think as well, like, if I'm totally honest, the monetary value of sharing your kids is very tempting because you also want to provide a better life for them.
Yeah.
Right? And the ads and stuff, that always always brings more opportunity if you've got children.
That's so true.
Again, I've become increasingly uncomfortable with that, even though my kids have always been up for it. You know, they don't understand at this age. Like, they can't appreciate and they may well feel differently in the future. So yeah,
even if they're begging you now to, like, my eldest, who's 12 now, when she was around 7 or 8, she went through a real phase of begging to start her own YouTube channel. I was like, no way in hell are you starting your own YouTube channel, but I really want to. And I'm like, yeah, but 18-year-old you might really regret doing that. And it's my job to make sure that you make good decisions, you know?
Yeah.
It's really tricky. What would you say has been the most challenging thing about raising your kids as a single mum?
Other people's reactions to it. I genuinely am, and I say this with my heart, and I think actually I'm more at peace with it than I am being a disabled mum, because I still get, if I'm totally honest, I still get frustrated by the limitations that my disability puts on me, which is totally normal and valid, and it doesn't mean that I'm not happy to be disabled. I am, but it's a constant work in progress. But with being a single mum, I 100% know that this is the right way for our family to operate, and we are so comfortable with how it operates, and with it's just the right way. And I know that public perception is like, but it's always better if the dad is there and has an active role and lives nearby and yada 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 yada. And I think coming up against that is a bit tricky, because I'm always coming up against that. Yeah. And also just like the public perception that, you know, because I'm disabled and stuff, and, you know, he left me, or he cheated on me, or that I should be pitied in some way because of all of this situation. And it's like, no, because I'm really happy being a single parent. I'm really happy. The only thing that I find a bit difficult sometimes is the kind of weight of tackling a particular parenting issue with my kids all falling to me. But then that happens a lot in coupled families as well. if we're like brutally honest, a lot of the times the mum feels like they're the only person.
They're the bad guy.
Make those decisions that can, lay down the law. And also things like, you know, not inviting me on a night out with other school parents because all the others are in a couple, and I think they don't do it because they're worried that I'd be offended or jealous, or there'd be a weird dynamic. And I'm like, I'll be fine, because I'm not jealous. Like, I'm cool. Let's go and have a drink, you know. But there's definitely something there around that as well, and it's just like, oh, you know. But
have you found that? Have you found that, you know, is there a school parents community that you've managed to tap into, or do you feel like you're on the fringes?
Yeah, I like coming. I like having the option, I guess. So, like, for example, one of the school mums texted me the other day and said, "Hey, I'm putting together a group for this this social event of school parents. Do you want to come?" And I think it's because she knew that I probably wouldn't, but I appreciate the invite, right? And for that particular thing, I didn't. But sometimes I do. Like, it just depends, right? And so, yeah, I guess just not letting, like, preconceptions inform whether or not I'm included. And giving me the option like you would anyone else. And I like being on the fringes. I've got a few like school parents who are friends of mine, but we're not a group. But that's how I work as a person. like all, none of my friends are friends. And that's how I like it, like that. So that's nothing to do with being a school mum or anything. It's just how I work better. I don't work very well in big groups. I find I get quite anxious. So yeah, but I do like a group thing every now and again, especially because I recognize the significance, especially when your kids are young, of making those connections with other parents.
Yeah, yeah. And how important is it to you for your kids to see you living as a proud disabled woman?
Oh, so important. So important. Not sure about proud as a word, but definitely as somebody who's totally accepting and tackles things head on and knows that the disability is not the problem when we're facing ableism or inaccessibility and stuff. That is so important. It would be important to me even if they weren't disabled. But because they are, I know that that is my job to instill that in them. And because the world is telling them something different all the time, it's a lifelong practice that I have to do. It's really important.
And what kind of conversations are you having with them about their disability, you know, and their experiences, I guess, of other people's attitudes they're coming up against at school and other places?
Yeah, I mean, they so far have been quite lucky in school, definitely. I think the second has been more lucky because the first went through the school first, and so it's less of a shock, right? But, you know, there haven't been that many overt instances of discrimination or whatever. But we talk about it all the time, but just kind of offhandedly, we'll be like, oh yeah, you know, you can't do that because, or we can't do that rather because we have dwarfism, but we can do this another way. Or I try and show them things that we can do other ways, and while acknowledging that it is harder and it is frustrating, because, you know, there's nothing worse than kind of having your feelings, your frustrations and your grief around not being able to do things that a non-disabled person can, dismissed or minimized. And so it's definitely important to me to hear, you know, any frustrations they have and acknowledge them, and often validate them with my own similar frustrations that I had at their age or whatever, as well as uplifting them and empowering them and stuff like that.
That's brilliant. Kathy, thank you so much for chatting to me today. The book, We've Got This, is out now, but tell us, where can we find you online to hear more about what you're writing and what you're saying?
Sure. So it's a bit complicated, my handle, but my handle is Kathy Ray Writes on Instagram and Twitter. So that's Kathy, CathyReay, and then the word writes, WRITES, which everybody puts writer, and I wish I had just put writer, but never mind. It's writes with an S at the end. On Instagram and Twitter, and more book stuff from me this year, so stay tuned.
Exciting. Thank you so much for joining me today, Kathy.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.